This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Dublin. I've been to quite a few fashion shows, not specifically in New York, but I've been to like quite a lot of the London ones and Paris. Actually, I've been to quite a few in
really?
Paris. Yeah,
the ones in New York are chaotic. But I found something yesterday that
really,
it's really outrageous.
I get so scared by the clamour of a fashion show and everyone kind of yelling, and I like the speed of them, but...
Yeah, then there's always interesting music going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those guys are...
For someone with like a short attention span, the speed of a fashion show is good for me.
This guy, this is Gypsy Sport, right?
Oh, wow.
And they're non-specific gender.
Oh, amazing. No, I didn't see this one.
That's from, I just go on Vogue Runway.
Yeah, I've got that.
That's where I found it.
Amazing. Yeah, I've got Vogue Runway app on my phone.
I don't always find things there.
Well, I think they're kind of, at Gucci, they just said they're doing their last separate gender fashion shows. So it's all going to be mixed from now on. They're just going to have one.
It's going to be confusing. Great.
But I think what they mean by that is like it will still be like men's clothes and women's clothes, but it'll be far more fluid as to what.
It's a gesture.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things on Gypsy Sport, when you meet the guy on the TV, the show, he comes up and starts talking about his. And he looks like a Scandinavian lawyer.
Mm.
You know, he's not one of the clothing. He's not wearing what his clothes are doing. Mm. And then he's got one picture in there for people who are overweight. I mean, he has this kind of you know, presentation for people, which is another category that they're getting onto.
Yeah, and I think I like. Especially for me, I think I never understood like how to be like girly, or I always felt like I was always sort of not sure whether I never felt kind of super comfortable with being really girly, and then I always found like men's clothes I really enjoyed.
Oversized men's clothes.
And I kind of became, especially in terms of performers. When I sort of look to like, you know, male artists a lot of what they were wearing, and I always kind of felt envious of the fact that their stage persona and their life seemed to be very on the same plane. They
really?
Just kind of walked from home onto stage. I mean, obviously like Bowie and stuff, that was very but they feel like. I kind of became jealous almost of like the simplicity of perhaps like a Nick Cave suit that he'd wear all day, every day, and then on the stage and then off the stage. So I think I was definitely looking at how to kind of bring the masculine into my work.
I don't know if I can wear some of these. I mean, they're like, but it this hermaphrodite idea. It has been a long time coming. I mean, it's been around for a long time. It used to be trannies that wore all this. Now it seems that show looks like it's catering entirely to trannies.
I think it's just everything's becoming more
fluid
which is a really, I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it becomes, everything is shared. And I think the idea of really inclusivity, and it's something that, you know, I would love to see us moving even more towards, you know, just this kind of fluid thing that comes from like love and sharing of ideas. And I think, and if we can start with clothes. Then,
you know. The thing that confuses me with those shows is whether you really get any leadership from them.
Fashion shows?
Yeah. They're always like following what... The guys that are in New York, for instance, are really all over the place. I mean, it's just chaotic. But I mean, you get some... But you always find that even they realize that you can have all this great line that's ferociously individual, and still you have to put in the straight piece of garment in there just so that everybody has... Oh, yeah, he knows that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't scare them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not scared, but, I mean, I'm just thinking about the market, which I know nothing about. I mean, it's like, you know, but... I wish they'd sort themselves out so I know where to go look for something. I just came across this by mistake.
What labels do you like? Like, what do you like to
wear? Oh, well, Hood by Air.
It'd be nice.
Totally. And Carmen must have, but they're really into business and into...
Yeah.
But I like people that you've never heard of before. You go into...
Have you heard of like the Vetements people, I think? Vetements?
Yeah, I've heard that name, yeah.
They're doing quite interesting stuff at the moment, like really playing with proportions and like making the sleeves really extra long and things like that, which... It's kind of it's playful, but it feels quite anarchic at the same time.
Are they doing women's and men's?
Yeah, but it's all kind of like you said, it all
blurs together,
like really enormous hoodies,
yeah,
and tracksuits and stuff. So it's sort of high. It's quite like it's high fashion, but there's a set kind of a feeling of it's like anarchy to it as well. I think it's
I think he's smarter with Gypsy because it's really sport material.
Yeah,
it's like gym material, and he's putting them all together into dresses made out of sports material and stuff like that.
And I like the guy Alessandro just moved to Gucci, and he's doing really amazing stuff over there. I think again, kind of these blending like what is masculine and feminine. So you know. He's making all the shows with men and women now, and they're kind of the patterns and stuff and everything. But even for the men, it's like incredibly flamboyant
florid.
Yeah, fun. But I think that's kind of definitely what I'm drawn to. I think is like maximalism. I'm not really like a minimalist.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether any of them. Some of them they used to do. It used to do a run that was based on the Hound of the Baskervilles or something like that. You know what I mean?
They would
have a suit.
Theme.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the suit would come, you know, from one of the Sherlock Holmes stories or something. And, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know what novels or books would really... I've still not been covered by them. Do you know what I mean? They're always like... I mean, I know what I... But I read this... do you know David Peace?
No.
David Peace is from Yorkshire. Taught English in Japanese schools. Wrote a series of novels about North Yorkshire, about 1984 was the name of one, 1987, 1989, all about the miners' strike and all about Thatcher and the way they... Then he went and taught English in Japan and came out with these two books about just post-war Japan after the bomb fell and everything else. And it's called Tokyo Year Zero. And he's got this really ferocious style of writing. He writes dialogue. He doesn't write descriptive prose. So you're thrown right in the middle of whatever's going on. And so anyway, I was just thinking, well, the Japanese clothes in Tokyo at the time would have been one kind of inkling about a design center for someone. But I just threw that out because I was wondering who you like to read.
Who do I like to read? At the moment, I'm reading quite a lot of poetry. I don't...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my dad gave me, for my birthday, my dad gave me all his old school copies of, you know, like T.S. Eliot and...
Yeah.
And they still all have his like, notes, like annotations. So they're quite precious to me.
I just bought some of him reading.
He used to do impressions to me of reading T.S. Eliot lyrics in a Bob Dylan voice. Like,
good.
It's like they could all be Bob Dylan's songs.
Yeah. Very good.
As we go now, you and I. The women, they come and go, speaking of Michelangelo. So, yeah, so him singing Eliot lyrics to me in a Bob Dylan voice is a big...
Very good.
And it works.
That's a great upbringing.
And so I've been reading... There was this poem... I couldn't... And Everyone Sang, which is a poem by, it's gone straight out of my head, I'll find it on, but it was Siegfried Sassoon.
Yes.
I just reread that.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was one of the most beautiful, I came across it in an anthology about birds, and it has this, and it's about people singing in the trenches, and he writes about it, and he says, and suddenly horror was lifted, terror disappeared, and everyone, and all was singing, and everyone was a bird, and the singing will never be done. And it was just the most... I should get it and find it and read it properly, but it was just... So just finding... And it seemed so sort of poignant.
Yeah,
and
no, those war poems are really... Just I mean, they get you.
Yeah, and
I just listened to Poetry Please this morning.
Yeah, I love Poetry Please.
And they had a poem in there. I've forgotten the name. It was he was covering Latin America, translations all.
Yeah.
And from southern Mexico, it was an Elliot Weinberger poem. And the way they talked, how tribes and primitive people have omens.
Mm-hmm.
So they think, well, if a bird whistles, then your friend will come, right?
Yay.
If the wind blows at midnight, then your horse will sleep. things that are really disjointed. He wrote a whole poem that really went off on all of that. You know, that whole idea of like, well, and you really know your horse will die. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you go...
Oh, just like things connected. Like,
yes.
Okay, totally.
And disconnected.
If a leaf falls off this bush...
Yeah, you will go blind.
I really like that because I've been reading quite a lot of poetry, and my friend Robert Montgomery, he does these big poems that are billboards, and he's an artist, so it's like poetry, and then it becomes this big billboard, and
it's just huge messages of
words, and it's really powerful.
Very good.
And I've been thinking about what it is to be, what a poem is versus what a song is, because I've actually started writing things that perhaps... just the idea of stuff that I couldn't put into a song. And so I had a poem that just became a huge list of things that I felt I could never put into a song because they weren't beautiful enough. In fact, they were sort of horrible. And, you know, like these artifacts that were sort of too bloody and ragged and like shameful to put them into a song.
I was just going to ask you, do you remember why... Do you remember the reasons why most things don't appear in that list, for instance, why they wouldn't be parts of a song? I'm just wondering what...
Well, I think maybe they could now, but I mean, firstly, some of them didn't rhyme.
Everybody writes stuff that doesn't rhyme.
Some of them didn't rhyme. Some of them were words that I didn't think were pretty enough or have enough. But also just kind of, I somehow felt that songwriting, because it was, I had like quite a swampy, I'm just about to turn 30 and my 20s were kind of super swampy and I was quite troublesome. And so, I felt like when I would write songs, it was almost like I would rewrite events into something that was grander and more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I could reimagine a situation that had kind of been kind of horrifying, like some kind of really crippling hangover or something that you'd done when you were drunk that you really regretted. And if I could reimagine it into this event that seemed grander and more biblical even and had mythology and in it, then I could sort of reclaim it in a way.
I think that's what Elliot Weinberger had in mind. I mean, he just started with a couple of things that really were sort of local tribes talking, and then he took it off. And that's a legitimate, what do you call it? It's a legitimate practice in literature.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Well, it's sort of turning the mundane into magical, but then I've become much more interested, I think, as I get older, in putting the mundane into the songs. I think it's good.
Yeah, it is. It brings people up short, but it also makes it interesting.
I just put the word car park into a song for the first time.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's very good.
I know. Yeah. Maybe like, in that car.
I know, that's a good way to start, actually. You just gave me an idea. Thanks. Where find the words that you really can't put into a song, and then put them in a song.
Yeah, I had the poem... I was like writing a poem. I was like about about weird stuff that happened. I had a weird thing where, you know, in my early 20s, my ex-boyfriend turned up outside my house on Valentine's Day. My new boyfriend and I lived with my mum. And my ex-boyfriend somehow tried to, like, kill my new boyfriend with a shoe. And, you know, you can't... That doesn't seem very songy, but when you put it into a poem, it kind of works if you put it in a list of other things that you felt like you couldn't put into a poem. But there's something...
Yeah, the idea of putting kill into a song is really... It's weird.
Yeah.
Because you may not be talking about the same thing as what it seems to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of killing anybody anyway is like... It's better done if you do it mentally than if you physically say his heart stopped.
Don't think his heart was really in it. Otherwise, he probably would have chosen something better than a shoe.
Right.
I think it was more the kind of the idea that these sort of and I would kind of write about these things that would happen, but it would have been a very obscure way that was further from actually what had actually happened, I think. As like almost like a self-protection.
Not that they didn't happen, that they were just...
No, that you write them, you rewrite them in your imagination into something completely different.
Yeah.
But yeah, now it's all car parks and reality things. Not really. I'm still sort of half in...
It's really a trick to be able to put something realistic into something really elegant. And
I mean,
and when it works, and you just wish you could do it more. I don't know. I wish you could do it more. But sometimes the reality takes over.
I think, again, and it's nice to sort of... I came out to L.A. just to...
Oh, I was wondering, you're moving today, weren't you?
Oh, I'm moving to do a writing session with someone who's making their album. But I came out to LA a bit early. I just come off tour, and really weirdly, I just started writing again almost immediately, which I think everyone is quite shocked by because they sort of assume that you'd need to rest. But it's kind of...
No.
I always want to keep doing
work
stuff.
Work is more fun than fun.
That's so true. That is so completely true. Work is more fun than fun. So, yeah. And especially as I get older,
yeah,
I just discover that the work is always where I've had my most fun. Yeah,
you've got a certain amount of time. You better get on it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I haven't stopped. I mean, I have a studio.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I just got off, not a tour, but it was London, L.A., Tokyo, and then back to L.A. In about 2 weeks. And it just was, it just knocked me sideways. But generally, I just go straight back in and start doing it. Because what you do when you're out of shape, when you think you're out of shape,
yeah,
things happen anyway.
Yes, totally.
I mean, your brain is just throwing this stuff out, and when you're in the studio, you've got a place to put it. I mean, it's like, you know, instead of sitting around and like scratching your head,
I think traveling as well, it's very nice. I like being busy, and there's something about being on tour that keeps you unbusy. You have one massive gig to do, but the rest of the day is sort of, you're exhausted, and in a really weird way, the rest of the day is actually quite is boring until this one big thing. So being actually making things and getting to do stuff every day now that I'm off tour is really, waiting for it.
Do you switch things up on stage then?
We kind of,
do you improvise on stage?
It's not really like the show itself isn't very choreographed, but we have, we're always trying to find what the best set list is and what will work. So we'll kind of start with what we think is perfect and then keep changing it all the way through till we really find, you know. But I find I quite like to do, because the band is really organic. There's not like big props. It's just lots. We got so many musicians on the stage now as well.
How many do you have?
It got really big this time. It was like three trumpets.
Wow. So they can't really improvise. You've got to...
The thing is, it has to be, because there's a lot of musicians now.
Sure.
Actually, the more we do a set list sort of over again, the better we get, because everyone has to become this one organism. And when there's 12 people on stage, you sort of actually... But for me, that can be... It's quite maddening because you're doing...
Because you're ahead of the band all the time.
Well, and also you're kind of doing... In some way, like, it's good because you get really slick because you're doing the same set list and you're getting it right. But after a while, it really becomes like Groundhog Day because you have, like, you wake up, you're going to the show, you're doing the same thing.
Yeah. How would you break it down if you decide, okay, one number in a set is going to be where... Nobody knows what they're going to do.
Why?
You have to choose two or three people.
That would be really interesting.
Just two or three people. People that you've relied on, you know, people that know you. And
that would be really fun. I mean
it would be... I don't know. I just wondered whether...
All my first gigs were improvised gigs.
There you go.
As I was 19, super drunk, and there were all these open nights and club nights in London all the time, open mics, and I would just get up and improvise whatever words came into my head. And if there was a band, I had a band that was a fully improvisational band.
Yeah.
We did two gigs, and then they were like...
Did you like doing that?
I did, but it's like flying with the wind. You have to just go wherever. We'd pick a chord, and then we'd start... But what was really interesting is a lot of my early songs came from that improvisational space because you're forced to just sing words and create.
It's the birthplace. I mean, you get a lot done like that.
Yeah, so that was kind of how I started to perform, really. But it was
also when you get off stage after doing that, it's so there's a residue in your brain. Well, if this happens, then that'll happen. And then you start having a catalogue of those things that really help you through. I mean...
I have to tell my guitarist and my drummer that we're now doing one fully improvised song. John Cale says...
Song. Sure, blame it on me. Because the bass player...
No, then they'd be like, okay, we got to do it.
A lot of my stuff is improvised. Because the guys I've got are really... They listen... all the time, and they just love it when you improvise, because they're
on stage, like freedom, when you're performing, yeah. It's improvised a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you have a skeleton.
Yeah.
And then you go from the skeleton to... you really get out into... It's what I really want them to be is I want them to be like the Gil Evans band live. You know, the Gil Evans that did all the sketches of Spain with Miles? That kind of dense harmonies and stuff. It's never gotten there, but I'm not worried about not getting there. Just having the thing float in the air, maybe you'll find something else. And but anyway, it's just... I started doing it on the road because it was driving everybody mad.
Doing the same thing.
It's like a hole in the lid of a kettle that lets the steam out every once in a while.
Yeah, I think that is a really nice. I think we'd be scared. You know, it would. It's definitely like you're making yourself
vulnerable,
which is really good. But
yes.
You are.
Yes.
Because I think we're kind of a that's getting it really slick and in time, and you know, so to really unravel in front of people would be something.
I think everybody would be amazed at it. I mean, just you got to set it up, and you got to prepare yourself for all of that.
Yeah.
But when you get uncomfortable. Keep going. Don't stop.
That's a good message just for life, anyway. No, but they say when you're uncomfortable in creatively, that's the best.
That's the best time.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
the best place you're supposed to be.
Yeah, the number of times I've written lousy lyrics and then I come back and look at them later and I say, "There's nothing wrong with it." You know, and I hated them at the time, and it's. So.
I know. I do think about some of the first stuff I ever wrote. And it was always like really macabre
kind of ghost stories. There was a lot of innocence, I bet.
Yeah, and I think that was really good.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That was good. And very innocent, and like the songs were a lot more like little stories I was telling to myself before I had an idea of like before I'd even gotten a style or the way I like to write songs.
I wonder what would happen if you decided to write a song that was talking about. You don't know what you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
That you don't... I don't know what I'm doing now, and I don't know what I'm going to be doing next, and I don't know what I'm going to be doing after that. It's it's really having to convince a state of mind more than anything else that you're talking about... Because you're pulling people in.
Yeah.
People are going to be following you. None of that is really worth really being scared about. It's really... I mean, because you're... You're exposing yourself and you're showing a side of yourself people don't normally see.
Yeah, that would be really...
Anyway.
Because I think you're trying to give people... Or you're trying to... sometimes when I'm writing a song, I'm trying to find an answer to something, to some kind of question. And I guess there's something... You'd be like, I don't know. I don't know anything. But yeah, I feel sort of at the moment. It's nice to feel ready to write again, and I feel I'm quite into.
You're energized.
Yeah, I feel energized about it, but I feel I'm quite into structureless things.
You know, it's gonna have its structure anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
You're gonna. Say, hey, look at that.
My friend said the style of writing I have is like, you're going along this way, you're going along this way. Oh, look over there! You're completely different.
That's great.
And then back. Because, I don't know, I think...
A lot of songwriting ends up being didactic if you don't do some of that.
I know, I...
If it comes like...
Yeah.
And country music does that to me. Yeah, I just don't. I don't want to be told quite what... I can tell what's going to happen, like, in the first three lines. And Dylan didn't do that. But then Dylan's not country music, I guess.
When you're composing a song, do you have any, like, I find, because I'm not actually trained at anything musically.
Hang on to that, that's important. Not being trained.
So I feel incredibly enthusiastic about anything that I can make because I don't think about it. I'm like, oh, any note sounds good to me because I don't really know how to play.
That's
so I'm
fine.
Like, this sounds so great. It's what a single note to me is the best sound that you can, just that ding, 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 ding. I'm like, this is amazing. So I was wondering, do you start? I mean, I don't even know. It's, I guess I just start with whatever I can start banging or whatever's in the room.
Exactly, yeah. I start with a groove. I got to have a rhythm going. And then I want to make it lurch a little bit so that it's off, but funky as I can. And that's it. Yeah. Some guys, the first guys I saw do that was Dr. John and the Night Trippers.
Dr. John is amazing.
And Dr. John's band, they were scary. Like, we opened for them in 1967, something. And they had these three girls with feathers coming out of their hair. And they all looked like voodoo goddesses. You'd run miles if you saw them in the dark. And a bass player with a giant handkerchief coming out of his back pocket. Huge guy with a white, let's say the boiler suit. And but the rhythms, you know, this little Louisiana thing, they've got that shifty kind of bass. And I got hung up on that. I still am. I mean, I think that 50 Cent does it too. And Dre does it.
I discovered Clips because I read an interview where you're talking about that song they did, Wamp Wamp Wamp, which that clattering percussive sound. That's how I kind of got turned on.
What song was that?
Wamp Wamp.
Yes.
And it's this amazing percussion, which is like. And I think, I'd read an interview where you had said, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, this is that really sparse percussion, but the groove is amazing.
Yeah, when I listen to that stuff, I'm very suspicious right away because this sounds very cool and simple, but really it's not. There's something else going on here that somebody knows what they're doing. You know? Although, I mean, there's a lot of innocence about rhythm machines when they first came out. There's a guy in Florida named Timmy Thomas, I remember. He was a gospel singer, I think, but he had a number one hit. It was number one with an anchor. You know, it didn't just go down, it just like stayed there. And it was just him and a rhythm machine and a Hammond organ. And it was fabulous. And rhythm machines really had to, you had to teach rhythm machines to have that lurch. Yeah. It doesn't have it. It's like, and in disco, you lost the plot in disco because disco was all about staying on that. You know what I mean? Like, you go to Studio 54 to do the gym, you know, work out all the liquor and the drugs you've had all day. And
Do you feel like when you're playing shows, do you think that phones are having an impact on like the interaction between a live artist and their audience?
I try to ignore it.
Really? You do?
I mean, I have to, otherwise it'd drive me nuts.
Yeah. I do wonder.
I think there's a greater danger of people on the street coming up and following you around and with the phones.
That's
much more aggravating.
I think.
Not just annoying, I think it's dangerous.
I mean, I wonder.
You don't know who these guys are.
I wonder sometimes.
I didn't want to bring that up. It's not something, you know. You know, we're cool.
I just wonder sometimes, I do now a song where I ask everyone to put their phones away in a show just for like one song with all, you know, if everyone just here can put their phones away.
If I heard your voice asking to put the phone away, I'd put it away right now.
And, you know, you just ask like, because like everyone just kind of be here and be together and experience this. And I think for a moment people are kind of we can. Like,
yes.
It's okay, we can just experience this as it is, you know. Because I actually kind of at the front row, I have to, if I see someone, you know, super like this, I actually have to go.
No, in Moscow, they were the worst ones were in Moscow. They had gigantic old videotapes, you know, with the real videotapes that you put in. Gigantic, they come up right in front.
And it's kind of, but I think it, once people do put their phones away, I notice that people are like, oh, we've really, that was great.
Yeah.
You know, we really had a good experience. So I wonder if, I don't know, I wonder if I'll do a tour next tour that it'll be like a no. Because I think people are slightly, and I think it's a kind of, it's almost like a fear of intimacy, because the intimacy.
You can do it. I mean, they'll do it for you.
Yeah, I thought about having like a no phones tour. Because it feels like you're having such an intimate exchange, or what I want is an intimate exchange, and it feels like it's a sort of barrier to that.
I started, I drove all the promoters in Europe crazy, no smoking.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you do a festival, and it's a drum festival, and that's a tobacco company. You're right, they're saying no smoking.
I felt a bit funny when I was playing Bottle Rock Festival, and I haven't drunk for like 2.5 years, and I was playing Bottle Rock in the Napa Valley, and they literally had like bars in the crowd, and I was like, hi. I was singing all these songs about like trying to quit drinking, and you know, like all these songs about, I was like, this song is about the reasons why I quit drinking. I know. I honestly thought like there was a bar in the crowd where people could get wine, and everyone was like, "It's like, do I?" Because I usually have some blurb, you know, you have the thing you say before a song, and usually I have a bit of like, "Oh, well, this is about like a really, really bad hangover that I had," and I was like, "Do I pretend hangovers don't exist?" Like, I don't know. Said it anyway.
No, I mean, they understood you.
Yeah, they got it.
Yeah,
but big, yeah, that's a funny
thing. It's all happening in a big bed of love for the audience.
Exactly. Guys, I've been there.
Yeah. If you think you're crazy, you don't know the half of it. Yeah.
But I think that's been kind of part of feeling re-energized and ready to go back to work as well, because this is the first time I've got off a tour and I haven't gone on an enormous bender, and it's sort of,
oh really,
yeah, no, I used,
you have a history,
I have a serious history. Yeah. A serious history. I know it seems very like demure, yeah. Now, but no, I was lunatic. I was a complete lunatic. but it was, you know, I got famous when I was 21, and yeah. It all came with the territory. It was like, you know, when I went I went on tour, they give me I could just have 2 bottles of vodka a day, and that was sort of deemed kind of vaguely
normal.
Yeah. And when you're, and I was always trying to keep up with all the other bands.
I should do all this chemicals that really I thought was driving my creative force.
Yeah.
And then my daughter was born, and I cut it all out, and I just went. Crazy. I just started writing.
Yes.
Ever since then.
No, I really feel that's, I sort of was scared because I thought I needed the darkness and I needed the pain of, you know, like chemicals or alcohol or whatever to, I thought that was my fuel. And actually this
is not true, is it?
And no, and I've come off tour and I feel so ready, and the writing, the words just come. So it really, I think it is a bit of a, I said that to someone when I first stopped drinking. I was like, what if I lose my thing, you know? What if I lose my...
The thing?
She was like, it's a trap. Don't believe that. It's
right.
A trap.
Yeah, good.
And no, I feel... And because I think it's about... I feel much more open to the world, and the things I want to write about is broader, as opposed to, you know, when I'm writing about What did I do when I was hungover, or how do I hate myself today? It's quite narrow, you know. You've only got your perspective, is your world is quite small because you're so, it's so internal. So I feel since cleaning up.
What am I gonna? Did you just say, what am I gonna do when you hate yourself today?
Yeah, what am I gonna do when I? It's like, oh.
Wow.
Like,
okay. Take two.
Take two. Yeah. Yeah. But it's,
yeah, you don't. That's kind of the thing about improvising, is that it allows you to, at the beginning, and there's no beginning and no end, and wherever you were, you know, before, you can pick it up exactly the same place and it still makes sense. You don't have to worry about it. Sort of, that's where's the thread?
Yeah.
Because generally, I don't think about threads. I set Dylan Thomas's music, the poems to music once.
Really?
And they, and then I thought, well, let's keep going. The plan was you just drink as much as you can, open up the book of poems, and then just do all of them. So you get going and you try and do all of them. There are tapes of me trying to do all of them. And a few of them worked fine. And then I went on and I got to Ezra Pound.
Oh, yeah.
Because I really liked Ezra Pound's user of stops the sheep from getting to market.
Mm-hmm.
And with Dylan Thomas, it was a lot of flow going on this point. But with Ezra, it was really severe. I mean, especially the stuff with the Chinese in it. I mean, just such an elitist view. And then I read about him, you know, being arrested for doing things for the government, or anti-US stuff. I thought, wait a minute. And then being anti-Semitic, and then writing letters to Roosevelt. And I just couldn't figure this guy out. I thought, what is he, you know, what a mess. And I thought, there's got to be something here that's right there. And I couldn't find it. In the end, I just said, hey, some things you can't figure out. And it was really disappointing to me, but you can't put all that nasty stuff together in one person and really expect to be able to find. I mean, you're trying to be Florence Nightingale here and save her soul or what? You know, it didn't work.
Yeah.
But a lot of other people did, so I'm, you know, trying to draw on.
I think who do you think like your favorite writers are then, if not
David Peace,
yeah.
And well, Le Carré, and you know, those popular guys. The literature stuff, I have a problem with novels.
Really?
I can't settle down with a novel. David Peace gets me because he's really dialogue. Oh, that was the other guy. George B. Higgins. Is this right?
George B. Higgins? No, I don't know him.
He's a state's attorney for Massachusetts. He wrote a bunch of books all about organized crime in Massachusetts. And they write about these characters. But he's got the same thing going for him. He's writing dialogue. It's all the time.
Yeah,
he's coming at you with dialogue. And you've got such a strong image of a personality that's good, and all the characters are in it. And the other guy that does that is Richard Price. Richard Price, all his books have, there's no explanation in it. You're thrown in the deep end, you gotta catch your breath when you can. But it's really great. I mean, the way the characters evolve and his sense of dialogue. He teaches kids in New Jersey, he teaches literature class to them, and he's. So he knows the street talk of you know, the new ones.
Yeah.
And anyway.
It was, I kind of sort of, I was thinking if I was ever going to write a book, but I sort of know what my voice is in a song sense. Like I have a voice if I'm writing a song. But again, I was wondering, like, it's all about, like, what is your voice? If you're writing a novel, like, what is the voice? Like, who is that person?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I would ever be able to find that specific voice of someone who
could
fill a novel. What would it be?
Yeah, it's a lot easier to deal with verses than it is to deal with pages. And, I mean, I started a bunch.
Really?
Yeah, I got one short story out that was okay, but I don't know, it's daunting.
It really, and I thought, I always worry I'd drown everything in metaphor because I'm so used to, like, songs, you know, interchanging the reality for the metaphor, and if I wrote a book, I'd worry I would just yeah, everything would be like one metaphor after the other after the other.
Yeah, it's got to be a way. I mean, I'm kind of fearless when it comes to improvising lyrics on stage, so I really should man up and get you know, write something so that it doesn't not that it needs to make sense all the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
maybe it wouldn't. I really like recently. Nick Cave did the sick bag song. I thought that was really wonderful because it was a sort of.
But he writes dialogue. He writes scripts.
Yeah.
He's got that in his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's.
I've never written something that is dialogue between two people because it's songs and it's prose and it's verses. So that's. I wonder.
Well, the reason I like dialogue is because you can contradict people. You can have people arguing. Like, most of the David Peace stuff is arguing. It's like, you know the Sam Peckinpah movies? You know those westerns that he did? The dialogue in that is really strong, and everybody's arguing. So is English playwright, The Birthday Party.
I don't know. What is?
He's the best. He died a while back. He's very anti-American, like seething the whole time. God, he wrote The Birthday Party, and he did the accident, the film with Dirk Bogarde. He wrote the script for that. And the thing about his dialogue is that it's an argument.
Mm.
You know, it sounds very natural, but here's this uncanny way of making it sound so polemic, so nasty, really. And so Peckinpah has that style, all of that. But I think for some reason, I got to the point at one point of thinking that if he did arguments and you could sustain them,
yeah,
that something would come out of the other end of this that would be another plot. You don't think into, you know, because when I start thinking in terms of plots, oh my God. I know this situation over here. I think I have the situation over there, but how do you keep it?
Yeah. Also, I think it would be, I don't know, maybe I could write arguments better than I can have them because I'm so conflict avoidant. I mean, if I wrote an argument, it'd have to be like, and then they just both apologized and it was fine because I'm so scared of conflict.
Yeah.
I think but maybe I could write them because I think I can be quite angry in my songs in a way that I can't, I find it difficult to be angry in person.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But yeah, my dialogue arguments would be short.
Well, no, I think what they were like, they didn't appear as arguments. Mm-hmm. They were just, you know, I like the idea of the unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
He'll tell you one thing here, and then down here you'll contradict it and pull a rug right from under your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you establish another, and then down here you'd pull the rug again. There's Alain Robbe-Grillet has that style, especially in his last book. But that's the beauty of some of those things about. Who was this guy? God, I'm going to remember it after I've gone. But is that these are very reasonable comments about something, but. After a while, it really starts getting on your nerves.
And
you start getting needled by all of this stuff. And this guy starts needling. And it's... anyway. He trailed off. Suspiciously.
I think, and as well... I kind of became... And it's like speaking as well. I think the more that I... like dialogue and even... speaking, like, the more that it's almost like the more famous I got or the bigger the shows became, the less I would speak on stage because I became much more much shyer about talking to that many people, because I feel, and even talking and like, so to talk to me, I feel like songs hold a protection around them, uh-huh. which is sort of magic, yeah. and you can communicate to me in a way that feels sort of safer, mm-hmm. and speaking, and also because it's, you get to write it down first and it's planned, and speaking is a form of improvising really, like all the time, like what is going to come out of my mouth, I don't know.
You know, I I got really angry with someone years ago, and I wrote a poem about him, really, it was called Curse,
that's,
and it was really in his middle age phrasing, Middle Ages phraseology as I could possibly get to make it like. And I showed it to this poet friend of mine, and I said, and he said, I don't know what you're worried about this for. I said, this is a love poem.
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah. And I said, dang. Yeah, it was really meant to go for somebody, you know, to really hurt them and tell them, you know.
It's kind of always, they're very close together, those two things, you know, love and hate. And so much of my songs have always dealt with relationships or how I relating to people. And it feels like actually, in terms of my relationships, I'm not a very, sometimes just not very articulate at all. And that, and yet if I put down into a song what I feel, this clarity comes through that I can't seem to get or find in...
From singing.
Yeah, from singing and from the act of sort of taking a pause and allowing, you know, not fighting for the words to explain how you feel, but just letting them come, I think. If I could find a way to apply that to, like, daily exchanges with like my boyfriend or whatever, that'd be really good. Because it seems like
we covered a lot of territory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like we have. Yeah.
You haven't got a cab running outside of you.
I don't know Issa, what time do we?
It's 2:30.
We're good. Whatever you. So what have you been up to here?
I just got back from Tokyo. Very interesting Tokyo.
Yeah, so I only went there very briefly. I really liked it.
Yeah, you get, that's the thing with everybody says, oh, you're on tour, that's great, you see all these different places. I said, no, I'm seeing the inside of a bus for, you know.
I know, I'd like to do some actual travelling because, again, yeah, the inside of venues, the inside of a bus, inside of that, so I think one day I will, yeah.
It's very interesting in Tokyo. I mean, I've been there a couple of times before. I did the OG show there, and I did Com, and so this time I went back, and it's still such an explosion of creativity in fashion. I mean, there's some days it's just like, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, they get these old costumes, they get old uniforms, military uniforms, they tear them apart and build different things with them. You know, I mean, like they recreate that uniform in different fabrics and all of that. And these are like, I found it in Florence too. There was a time when we stopped playing for a day off in France, and I went running around, and sure enough, soldiers all over the signs, you know, sales. And in one of them, I found this jacket that was a Scottish military jacket, like a Highlands jacket, that was gorgeous. And it was kind of, I bet it was kind of end of term, where people are coming out of design school and they've got their little ideas that they've made for, or they're trying to get jobs. Their application consists of this. I'm guessing. But the place was full of stuff like that. It was really great.
Is that in Florence?
Yeah. And it was, you know, there were these pop-up shops that just, you know, had sale on the outside. And you went in, and if you're lucky to find something in your size, and you're lucky to find something in your size in Japan, too, because there's all these Asians.
Do you like Dries?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's very classy. Yeah. But I like HBA better. I mean, I got a dress from HBA.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, very good. I just went to Selfridges when I was in there. Got another a skirt. It was really good.
Oh, from Hood by Air?
I don't know who's from. I thought it was Vivienne Westwood to begin with, but it's not. It's somebody else. But it's really beautiful. I mean, I don't think I'm going to get that far.
Oh, well, it's been so nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
And,
how many days off do you have?
I'm going only for 3 days to Malibu, and then I'm going home. I'm turning 30, and then the big 3-0. Yeah. And then I've got, you know, I just keep working, but it's nice to start working on the next thing when no one is expecting you to do it. Because
it allows you some privacy.
Yeah, because you can just get on with it in a very in-house way. And all the studios that I like to work in have hardly any equipment, because anything fancy makes me feel uncomfortable. So I'm kind of just going to work.
You and Isabel have been working on this for, I believe Isabel is your partner.
Yeah.
So she's a compadre?
We write together, or I'll just sort of do it on my own a bit. And I've kind of been doing this one on my own to start with, and then I'll start writing with her when she comes back. And but yeah, she was sort of the first, because I kind of didn't really know what sound it was I wanted to make, and people were setting me up with guitarists, or because I had songs, but I thought I needed to maybe be the front person in someone else's band, or I didn't know I could do it myself. And Izzet I met, and she just gave me this £100 Yamaha and a stick. And just was like, make whatever you want.
Yeah.
So it all just came.
Very cool.
Yeah, and that's like how the first songs were all made, really, in this very, no equipment, really. We were using pens as percussion and, you know, a detuned drum that we'd stolen from someone else. And it actually, the not having much was a real...
Absolutely.
That really made all the difference. Yeah. So now if I go in studios where there's loads of equipment, I can't do anything with this.
Certain amount of knowledge. Yeah, it caught up with me eventually, though. I mean, eventually, I was curious, so I wanted to... I do get a computer on stage. I mean, it goes through the set. You just go click, 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 and the sounds change. Otherwise, you don't, you know, you have... And then you need to fit in all the classical musicians in on top of the electronics.
Yeah.
Which is always a problem. But it's interesting.
I had fun with the orchestra. Because the Final Fantasy, we did a collaboration with this Final Fantasy video game, and they actually had the budget to give
it's
a full orchestra, and we don't have, but I love bringing like that classical stuff in, so it was a real pleasure to have like a budget to get an orchestra.
I really went off because it reminded me of my upbringing and all that.
Oh, really? Classical, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's... And I didn't... really getting strange noises out of them was more important. We're all electronic. There's no point.
We actually did a song yesterday where we put a cello through loads of like really distorted like guitar mics, and that was really fun.
Yeah.
So I think, and we definitely don't, there's no orchestras that we can get hold of right now. So, but cello drew like a one of those amps, sounded really amazing.
There you go.
But yeah, it's sort of piece by piece, I think it will come together. But so far, it's just kind of like one note, like sticks banging on the walls again.
Yeah, I did this concert, I just did the Bowie tribute. Had this very interesting bunch of musicians, were like Andre.
Yeah.
And they had all really excellent players. And if you told them to play out of tune, they didn't blink. Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that. And play that. Fact, just let it drip a little bit. And everybody was really enthusiastic and got on so well. Fabulous. And really good, you know, you knew they could play anything, really. But he's got to keep them honed. I mean, he's, you know, it's a responsibility when you have an outfit like that. And he does it pretty well. He writes all the parts. And I don't really want to write parts.